or good evening, depending on where you are in the world, and welcome to Information Week Live for the week of October 9th, 2016. I'm Kurt Franklin, Executive Editor at Information Week, and your host for this episode of Information Week Live. You know, we bring you here on this show the best, the biggest, the most interesting, you know, frankly, it's just whatever catches our attention for this week. And we hope it catches your attention, too. To let us know what has caught your attention, please feel free to join us in the online chat here at informationweek.com or send me a tweet at KG4GWA. I've got TweetDeck up and looking forward to seeing what you have to say here at Information Week Live. Well, two people who I know will have something to say are joining me around the virtual studio table. First off, from Information Week, our editor-at-large, Charlie Babcock. Charlie, welcome to Information Week Live.
Well, Kurt, it's always a pleasure to talk with you.
And joining us from our sister publication, Dark Reading, we have senior editor, Sarah Peters. Sarah, welcome to Information Week Live.
Thanks for having me, Kurt. Always a pleasure.
Sarah, I wanted to say, just to get started, that I'm pleased that you were able to find time to be with us this week, especially after Dark Reading was named the most influential information source on data security in a survey that was just released. I assume this is something that has all of you feeling very proud over there at Dark Reading.
Well, it does, and I decided that I would still come around and talk to you guys because it's always important, they tell me, to remember the little people. To make sure you don't forget where you came from. You don't want to get above yourself too much or people, you know, don't like you as much. So I won't forget your names when I become famous.
We appreciate that, and we'll look forward to being mentioned prominently in your memoir when that comes out on this important event. That was a big thing that happened to Sarah. We're going to get back to Sarah and find out, as we always do, what sort of big things were happening in the world of security. But Charlie, wanted to give you a chance first. I know that you spend most of your time looking at things like cloud issues. Was anything going on in the cloudy side of computing this week that caught your fancy?
Well, I'm still trying to digest what it means when VMware and Amazon Web Services form a close partnership. And I think it means that you'll be able to vMotion a workload in your data center directly into the cloud using all the tools and management console conventions that you're already used to. And that strikes me as significant. I'm trying to check into some of the details of that and how it will work and what people think of it.
Well, I've got to ask, it seems like over the past, let's call it quarter, the past 3 months, we've seen an awful lot of these alliances and partnerships being talked about. Are we reaching a point where basically all of the big services are going to partner with all of the big operating system and hypervisor providers so that you can essentially get anything anywhere? The precise where is just going to depend on the contract that you can get with whatever the service provider is.
Well, I'll give you my best software expert answer, and that is, that depends. in effect, we have camps forming, trying to form alliances and agreements and partnerships that can somewhat serve as a counterweight to the massive success of Amazon Web Services. So VMware is extremely successful in the data center. It sought to establish its own public cloud. That effort didn't go as far as VMware wanted it to. As a matter of fact, it would be safe to say that it is no longer inclined to invest in that effort at anywhere near the level it had been trying to, say, 3 years ago, 2 years ago. And it's not been very, not much of a return on investment there. On the other hand, a partnership with a cloud provider like AWS, with kind of an open channel between their two environments, making it easy to move things between them, that could further enhance VMware's success in the data center, AWS's success in the cloud. It's, I think, a couple of years from now they'll look at it and say, "Well, this was a no-brainer. We should have done this years ago." And not spent so much effort on vCloud Air, which is still kind of its pilot project or its test bed for public cloud operation.
Well, it does indeed sound like this is the kind of thing that could be really important. And it's going to be interesting to see, as you say, which side finds it more so. I've heard a lot of people indicate that VMware, at this point in their evolution, kind of has more to lose because they're under much more competition. They've got competitive pressure from everything. The Microsoft is competing hard against them in the hypervisor market. And then there's the entire container architecture that it seems is making a lot of people look away from virtual operating systems to just containers. I know that you've written a lot about container architectures. From where you sit, do you see companies deciding that they're going to go with a container architecture rather than a hypervisor-based virtual operating system architecture, or for the moment at least, are the two sort of existing side by side in a lot of organizations?
Well, I wouldn't even say they're existing side by side. The tools and the environment is there for the virtual machines. The enterprise IT managers who manage the data center know the ins and outs of virtual machines, and while they are interested in the efficiencies and speed of containers, they have not adopted them at anywhere near the same level as virtual machines when it comes to production systems. So we are a couple years away before we have anything like the management capabilities. Kubernetes is coming along, deployment capabilities, lifecycle management capabilities for containers that will be a match for virtual machines. And even the cloud providers who could realize greater efficiencies by offering only containers don't do it. They run their customers' workloads in virtual machines, even though that means firing up another operating system and requiring the memory and compute power to do that. You could run multiple containers under one operating system and save memory, save compute cycles, create satisfied customers by speed of response. They're not doing it yet. And when the day comes that they are, then I'll believe that containers and virtual machines are equals in the enterprise data center, and containers are somewhere headed toward having the upper hand. We just are not there yet. I'm interested in containers. I think they are a significant step forward in many ways. But managing things remains a really major concern for the people who take responsibility for data center operations. And the two things do not belong on the same plane under current circumstances.
Well, that's a great perspective, and it really I think, gets to something that is an issue for a lot of us here in the press. We tend to look forward. And so it's very easy for us to focus our attention on things that are exciting, that have a lot of potential, that are new, but may, as you point out, still be several years from really taking hold in the enterprise and being deployed on the production side in any sort of significant way. And that's a great perspective to have, that sometimes we here in the tech press need to look at what's happening now and talk about things in terms of what's happening now rather than in the rather experimental what could be happening in the future. Sarah, I know that over on your side of things in security, a lot of people complain that the vision is actually too much in the past, that security is often reactive rather than being proactive. What are people in security reacting to this week? And you know, let me first start out with saying, do you think that's a fair wrap? Do you think that security is by its nature reactive, or is there an awful lot more forward thinking, proactive work that's going on than most of us know about?
I think it depends on what you're looking at. I think that in practice, we have a very reactive way of doing security a lot of the times. Instead of building security in, and by that I mean just writing more secure code, you know, just having more secure systems in the first place, firmware and software, we're slapping security on after the fact and finding security flaws after, you know, once they're already being exploited, and then rushing in a panic to fix them. And I think that's what people mostly are talking about when they say we're reactive as opposed to proactive. But we also have the problem in security with people sounding sometimes like conspiracy theorists, and that we're overreacting all the time because there's like this, oh my goodness, there's a vulnerability, and if 18 million different things all come together at the same time and the stars are all aligned, somebody might be able to make some horrible thing happen and the whole world will end. And both, you know, those of us in the media and those of us just in the industry as a whole have to parse that all out and say, okay, that sounds terrible, but is it really going to happen or not? And we have to have this risk management approach of, you know, is this a realistic, how realistic is this? How much of a risk is this? And when we're saying how much of a risk is it, is this a threat, you know, to my organization, is it a bigger risk to my organization? How much do I really need to worry about it? And does the organization down the street, maybe they really need to worry about it and I don't even need to think about it at all? Because obviously, depending on what kind of business you're in, depending on how big your business is, depending on a whole lot of different factors, the security threat, the degree of threat will vary quite a bit. So depending on who you're talking to and what you're talking about, we either are categorized as overly reactive or overly proactive, and usually not the correct amount of either. Does that make sense?
It actually does. And I think it has to do with the fact that we tend to, when we look at security, we tend to see what's happening today and either because what's happening today is often cast in terms of breaches and vulnerabilities found and exploits discovered. The response is going to be either, gee, you should have been looking at this, or why were you looking at things that haven't happened yet and not at what was going on your own doorstep? And I think that in IT security, as in pretty much all security, the practitioners suffer from a zero tolerance. They are judged typically not by all of the exploits that were patched before they were taken advantage of. They are judged not by all the vulnerabilities that they built fences around, but by that one vulnerability that they missed, by that one exploit that someone outside found first. And like I said, I think that is true of pretty much all security professionals, which is why the first reaction of most security professionals in most areas is to lock things down, because they recognize that they can be complained about for locking things down, or they can be kicked out of their job for not. It's a difficult situation, no question.
You know, the good news for them, though, is that there's not enough of them. And so they're less likely to get kicked out of their job these days. We just heard, I think, I don't remember the exact number. I should look it up. But just like a week or two ago, there was research that the average information security professional is getting a job offer, an unsolicited job offer, like twice a week. I think we're all in the wrong business, guys. We should go get our CISSP certificate or something.
I think I started having my, gee, perhaps I'm in the wrong business discussions back around the time that Apple was putting out their first public offering. But it is an interesting thing, and I find it fascinating that there is that tolerance for error, because there just is not an overwhelming excess of professionals. Charlie, I wanted to come back to you for a second, because you know we were talking about containers versus virtual machines. When you're talking to suppliers and to companies that are deploying all of these out in the world, does security come up at all as a reason for them to be looking in one direction or another? Or, you know, for that matter, does it come up in the discussion about virtual infrastructure? Or is that something that they tend to assume will be taken care of by the folks out at the network edge?
Comes up all the time, absolutely, and that's one reason virtual machines will hang around a long time. The hypervisor is a very limited attack surface, and I believe the hypervisor makers have figured out a way to shrink it even further. It's a restricted number of commands. I used to know the number, 68, 72, something like that. And you can put a firewall next to the hypervisor and have the firewall constantly ask, is this a legitimate hypervisor command, or is this an attempt to change the way, change the code that the hypervisor is acting on? And so it becomes a very minimal attack surface compared to an operating system with all of those millions of lines of code. And So people like the hard boundary represented by the virtual machine and the hypervisor gatekeeper. And it's one of those guarantees that you can put two competitors on the same server, and the hypervisor is going to make sure there's a hard boundary between them. Containers, that boundary disappears, and competitors' data is in the same server memory. It is divided, it is walled off by logic, but nevertheless, if something went haywire, there could be some slop over, there could be some data capture, that kind of thing. Basically, container makers have built in more and more guarantees that that'll never happen. But I don't know that they stand up in court the way the virtual machine would. So we keep sticking with that hard boundary there.
The hard boundary that runs through the middle of a courtroom, that's one that I think we deal with often in IT, although pretty much every technologist I know hates it. They would much rather keep their discussions only on the technology side,
mm-hmm.
and not on the legal side of things.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, well, lots of interesting stuff going on. Well, let's see if we can move away from virtual security. And, Sarah, I didn't get a chance to ask you, were there any big pieces of security news this week? Any exploits that bring us closer to the end of the world?
Well, actually, I think last week we were talking about how the U.S. officially said that they placed blame on Russia officially for the attacks on the Democratic National Committee, and said that basically Russia, like some kind of state-sponsored entity, was actively trying to mess up the U.S. election. And what happened this week was that they officially said that there would be some proportional response to those hacks. What proportional response means, we are not sure. We're not sure if when that proportional response occurs, that the public will learn about it. We're not sure if that's going to come in the form of offensive cyber attacks launched by American-sponsored cyber attackers on the Russian government somehow, or if that's going to come in the form of some kind of trade sanctions on Russia or what. And this is new ground for us. So that's kind of it's big news. There's a lot of unanswered questions. Kelly Jackson Higgins did a story on Dark Reading on this earlier this week, and one of her sources put it really well by saying we've never been here before because we have no Geneva Convention for cyber yet, and this is all kind of uncharted territory. We're really not sure what's going to happen next. So that's probably the most intriguing thing that's happened this week.
Very, very interesting. You know, I kind of like the idea of a Geneva Convention for the cyber world, although I have the strangest feeling that in the same way that the 21st century has seen us move away from big declared wars between nation states, which is what the Geneva Convention was designed to regulate, most of what happens in the world of cyber espionage and cyber warfare will take place among groups that have at best shadowy ties to nation states rather than groups that go around planting the flags of their sponsors on their exploits. I could be wrong. It might be that everybody leaves little colored virtual stickers on their work when they go in and hack an enemy's infrastructure, but that seems an awfully strange thing to expect.
No, it's an interesting, it's a tricky, sticky wicket, because there's also this underground market for code. I mean, there are exploits that you can buy. It's not even all underground. I mean, you can actually buy exploit code if there are certain companies that supposedly just sell their code to law enforcement, just sell their code to governments, and supposedly try to do it all on the up and up and are very careful about it. But as we learned last year from the big doxing attack on Hacking Team, which was one of the companies that claimed to do just this and claimed to vet the organizations they sold to very carefully, we found out that they didn't actually vet the organizations they sold to all that carefully. They were a lot more a lot more lax with who they sold to. So some of the spyware that they developed and some of the exploit tools they developed got into the hands of some pretty nasty organizations. And also, just because you develop something for one purpose doesn't mean that it can't, it can't end up in the hands of somebody that you don't expect. Also, because organizations, just like we in the on the good guy side of things will use third-party components when we're developing software, malware writers do the same thing. They'll take a piece of exploit code that was developed for one thing and they'll plug it into an exploit somewhere else. So you'll see some piece of exploit code that some guy in France wrote and another piece from some guy in China wrote, and it might be a guy in Iran who puts it all together and is the one who launches the attack. But there will be all of these little, like you're saying, stickers from all over the place. So how do you know necessarily who launched the attack, who wrote the exploit, when you've got these pieces from so many different places? It's harder to do attribution when you've got so many different elements in these binaries. Attribution was a thing that was very, very difficult to do just a few years ago, and the industry has gotten much, much better at it, partly by getting to know the main threat actors a lot better, getting to know their behaviors, just basically watching them and learning what their MO is, so you can recognize them next time you see them. But it's still not an exact science, and it's still something everybody has to be very careful about doing, just in case they get it wrong, because then we end up in a position where you've got one government coming out and saying, we're going to respond to this. That's big news.
That does sound like big news, and it sounds like the sort of thing that could lead to even bigger news in the future as some of these countries or organizations pull the trigger on some of these possibilities. So not surprisingly, we have lots to look forward to from you over at Dark Reading. Well, I hate to say it, but we've gone through another half hour here at Information Week Live. It seems to me that our time absolutely flies, because I'm impressed not only with the topics that we have to discuss, that's one of the great things about the industry we're part of, but about my partners in crime here, who always bring interesting perspectives and interesting stories to us here at Information Week Live. Well, let's find out what each of you has on the agenda for the coming week. Charlie, let's start with you. What should folks be on the lookout for from you at informationweek.com?
Well, I'm always interested in advances in data center infrastructure. I'll be talking to someone next week from Aligned Data Centers, a modern data center builder who claims they have come up with a way to recycle the heat that is produced in any given data center. So we'll see what he's got to say.
We'll look forward to that. And I know that you tend to let folks know when your stories hit on Twitter. How can people keep up with that and find you on Twitter?
Well, I'm not tweeting as much as I used to, but I will try to keep it up. It's at BabcockCW.
Everyone really ought to follow that. And speaking of following, Sarah, what should people be looking for at Dark Reading as they follow you over there?
Well, I just had a piece go up today that is about six things that we still don't know about the Computer Fraud and Abuse Act after even 30 years, because the CFAA will hit its 30th birthday on Sunday. So you can look for that today. Next week, I'm going to be looking at some more IoT security stuff. And you can find out more about that on Twitter at Sarah Peters when I'm good about tweeting, which I've been really slacking off about. But that's where you can find it when I am good about it.
Well, ideally, all of the listeners flooding into your follow lists will spur you to just tweet your little fingers off, and we'll look forward to that. As for me, early next week, I've got a piece coming up. You know those really delicious French fries that everyone loves at McDonald's, even when they're such healthy eaters that they claim that they never go to McDonald's? Well, those little French fries don't just make themselves, and McDonald's did a new infrastructure for helping onboard more than 700,000 new team members a year. So I talked to the head of learning technology there at McDonald's about that infrastructure. That piece will be hitting informationweek.com on Monday. Later in the week, we'll have a podcast in the Information Week's expert voice on that same McDonald's project. And between those, I'm going to be down in Orlando at the Gartner Symposium talking to lots and lots of CIOs, IT executives, and experts in the field. So lots of stuff coming out of Gartner. Be following me on Twitter at KG4GWA. I'm going to try to do a lot of tweeting from the conference and the expo floor to keep everyone up to date if you're not able to make your way to the Swan and Dolphin there at Disney World. Well, this has been a fun show for those of us on this side of things. We hope it's been an enjoyable show for you. I hope that all of our shows here at Information Week Live are enjoyable for you. We're here every Friday at 3 p.m. Eastern, noon Pacific, and we hope that you'll join us. If you're not able to join us then, remember that we are available on a streaming version, and very soon you'll be able to subscribe to Information Week Live on iTunes and Google Play. We'll certainly let you know when that is happening. Well, for Sarah Peters, Charlie Babcock, and all of us here at Information Week Live, this is Kurt Franklin saying thanks so much for listening. We'll see you next time.